Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Philip Jenkins, the Distinguished Professor of History at Baylor University and co-director for the Program on Historical Studies of Religion in Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion. Recognized by a number of periodicals, such as The Economist, as being America's foremost historian of religion, Professor Jenkins has authored nearly 24 books on a wide range of topics, from the impact of the turbulent 1960s to the social construction of serial murder. His books on religion include The Next Christendom, The Coming of Global Christianity, which we featured on our show before, Laying Down the Sword, Why We Can't Ignore the Bible's Violent Verses, Jesus Wars, How Four Patriarchs, Three Queens, and Two Emperors Decided What Christians Would Believe for the Next 1500 Years, and most recently, The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade. Given that we've just passed the centennial anniversary of the outbreak of hostilities in the war to end all wars, I've decided to make this book the topic of our discussion today. We will post links to The Great and Holy War, as well as Professor Jenkins' other writings on our website, so please visit. Philip, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much.
Before diving into the religious nature of World War I, I want to first go over some of the brief background of the war itself. You historians, you've had about a century now to sort out the causes of this conflict. Has there been any agreement as to what led to one of history's most bloody conflicts?
It very much depends on how immediate or how distant to the event you want to go. So, for example, people would agree freely on the immediate events leading up to the war. There were tensions between particular nations. There was a famous assassination, and that led to an escalating series of interactions. So the two great alliances came to war in July and August of 1914, and that's all familiar. There's a lot of debate about whether any of the countries could have pulled back at the last moment, but that's the general picture. The wider issue then is the broader ideologies and goals of the different powers, and how far any of them had long-term plans in which war was a major likelihood. Many people look at Germany in this regard as having an ideological outlook that was going to involve war. More recently, other people have looked at Russia, and the basic problem is that whichever of those countries you look at, Germany and Russia both had far-reaching ambitions. Both of them were very messianic in tone, and Europe only had room for one messianic nation.
Yep, and they were pretty close to one another, so you could see that they would butt up against one another. You mentioned the German ideology, and you used also the term messianic in tone. Was this ideology just a basic nationalism? Because I know if we go back several decades into the 19th century, Germany was trying to unite and expand. It fought a series of three wars against a number of different places, including France. Is it largely secular nationalism, or is something else involved here?
Germany is a key example. When Germany actually goes to war in 1914, the religious tone of the nationalism is just overwhelming. But throughout the country, every particularly Lutheran pulpit is full of ideas about this being a moment of transfiguration. They use the word. And the other one they use is this is a new Pentecost. So there's what you might call a kingdom of God moment. There's a great sense of exaltation. But that goes much deeper. Germany, as you say, was united in 1871. And for German religious and patriotic thinkers of the time, that seemed like a miraculous moment, and that miracle was extended with Germany's enormous expansion of power and wealth and population over the next 40 years. Those Protestant theologians take the lead in formulating and promulgating a radical new nationalism, which is absolutely religious in tone. I use the phrase the kingdom of God, and that is very specifically what people are saying, that the kingdom of God is not just a notional event for the millennium, it's something which will come to pass in our lifetime, and that Germany would be the nucleus of that kingdom of God. So they see Christianity as leading that charge, and more specifically Lutheranism, and German Lutheranism. So it's those nationalist thinkers who don't just respond to the forces of nationalism, they drive the forces of nationalism. And you cannot understand that German nationalism except by putting it in a Christian and specifically Protestant framework.
You also mentioned Russia. What is happening in Russia this time in terms of that? I know that they had social conflict dating back to 1905. There was a mild revolution, you could say, there. Do they have the same kind of messianic visions of expansion that the Germans have?
You know, it's interesting. Yes, they do, and drawing on totally different roots. One of the odd things about Russia is, you say they have the social unrest, and we tend to write history backwards from the great Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. In the years immediately before the First World War, though, Russia, oddly, is going through a major religious revival that is reaching intellectuals, that is reaching deep into the working class. You have all these social gospel preachers, all of the Orthodox Church. And that is reflected in nationalism even more so than in Germany, but drawing not on Lutheran roots but on Orthodox roots. And that particularly manifests in this vision of what Americans would be very familiar with, and the concept of manifest destiny, the idea that there is a God-given role for Russia to expand in particular directions, and specifically to absorb absorb the Ottoman Empire and to liberate its Christian populations there. In the 1870s, for example, there was almost a European war over Russian expansion into that area, and that really drives the Russian move in 1914. So, as I said, they also see themselves in a messianic role, supported not just by the Orthodox Church, but by the many ancient and medieval prophecies that are still circulating, are still very popular, in which a great Christian king, a new Constantine, will destroy the Turks and liberate the Christians. So there again, we have this messianic image.
Hmm. Now, it's interesting that you're talking about this. I'm assuming that most of the scholarship that we see on World War I today relies on very secular explanations, seeing the conflict largely in materialistic terms and largely ignoring these religious undertones, or in some case they might actually be overtones. You're trying to rectify this tendency by historians to just view things in strictly materialist terms, right?
That's right. And I'm also interested in how that very secular interpretation grew. And I think a large part of it is a reaction from the 1930s onwards against the First World War having any particular moral quality of being in any sense a good war. And it's also at that point when European and American intellectuals become very secular themselves. And the idea is that if they don't take things seriously, then the people they are studying don't take things seriously. And it's only at the end of the last century, with the encounter with Islam, that scholars realize that, yes, indeed, in modern times, religious motivations could be very serious. That doesn't mean, of course, that religious motivations operated in a vacuum, But as throughout history, people tend to combine military, political, economic, and religious schemes as all ways of understanding God's will. And unless we see that kind of element in 1914, I would argue we're missing a very large part of the story. To put it another way, the First World War is not the start of secular history in the 20th century. I prefer to see it as the last phase of a long and deeply rooted tradition in Europe of religious politics and religious war.
That is something that we're going to be picking up here. But here's something that I want to do that I've never done before, and I'm going to give you the chance to respond to a critique that came up on your book's Amazon.com website. And we usually link all the books back to Amazon.com. And you can look and many favorable results. I love the book. I love reading the book. You have a very fluid way of writing. But one of the critics writes, quote, "The main idea behind this book is simple. Religion was the driving force behind World War I. This view is extremely wrong, and it distorts the real motives which were responsible for the unleashing of the war." Unquote. How do you respond to that?
Well, there are two things that I never look at. One is my Wikipedia entry, and the second one is Amazon comments on my book. So that's the first I've heard that one. What I would say, without reading what it says in detail, I am not suggesting, as I just remarked, that this is solely a religious war. What I'm saying is religion is an important element. It is an important frame through which many participants see the issues of the war. And the more you excavate particular individuals, the key people in this story, the more you see not just religious motivations, but often very surprising non-orthodox, esoteric motivations. The example I choose, for instance, in 1918, General Ludendorff mounts his mighty offensive on the Western Front, and Ludendorff's ideas seem absolutely batty to us. He's a neo-Norse pagan. On the other side, you have brilliant strategists like the British officer J.F.C. Fuller, who designs basically a large part of modern armored warfare, who does the blueprint for what would become blitzkrieg warfare, and is a disciple of the English Satanist Aleister Crowley. And you look at one or two of these people and you think, well, they're, you know, quirky individuals. But then you realize that it's very hard to find somebody who does not have religious motivations of a very curious kind. The German commander who invades France in 1914 is General von Moltke, and he is carrying in his pocket mantras that have been given to him by the great German occultist, living in Switzerland at that point, Rudolf Steiner. So it's not just a few isolated people, it's people at the highest level of society. Now, that's a non-Orthodox tradition. If you look at, Douglas Haig, you cannot understand him without his Presbyterian background, and so on. We make a terrible mistake if we apply modern secular attitudes to the leading figures at this time. Religious ideologies pervade political thought.
Let me ask a little bit of a historical methodology question here, if I can. It's interesting that you mentioned these guys, Ludendorff and Fuller and von Moltke, having occultist type of attitudes or spiritual beliefs. How do you find that out? Is that in their memoirs? Are other people writing about this? It almost seems that they might want to cover this type of stuff up, and do you have to find personal diaries, or and it goes back to the other historians too, the more materialist historians. Is this something that's easy to overlook, or is it sitting there and they just blatantly ignore it?
Usually it's hiding in plain sight. So for example, if we're looking at Germany, One of the absolutely crucial figures is a man who is a very big deal in Protestant intellectual history, who is Adolf von Harnack, hugely influential writer on church history, on early Christianity. He's an absolute dominant figure. You know, if in 1914 you're an American or a Brit and you claim to be interested in early Christianity and you don't read von Harnack, then you have no right to participate in any intellectual discussion. It's also absolutely an open secret that he is a very, very close friend and ally of Kaiser Wilhelm, that he is, in fact, writing speeches and propaganda for the Kaiser, that he's a leading figure in mobilizing German intellectuals to support the war, and that his ideology, his religious framing of the war pervades all that. It pervades the speeches. It pervades the mobilization of the intellectual world. If you are studying German propaganda, then you cannot ignore von Harnack. You cannot ignore his religious, Protestant, liberal Protestant ideas. And it sort of puzzles me that people don't see that. There's nothing there that is in any way secret. It's all easily available. I'm not suggesting that there's anything like a conspiracy of silence, but the phrase is we see things not as they are, we see things as we are. And if you're assuming a very secular approach to politics and the war, then that is indeed what you will see. But when you look, as I say, at these individuals, whether it's von Moltke, Ludendorff, and so on, they operate in a very, very spiritual universe.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you note how scholars often view the world in the terms of how they see the world. And you also mentioned earlier on about these scholars in the 1930s taking a very secular turn, both American and European scholars. And then these would be the first set of scholars writing about World War I and basically setting the tone for future scholarship here. And I want to talk briefly about the intellectual climate around World War I and possibly leading up to 1930 when these scholars are writing. It is a really interesting pivot point in history. You're about a century into the Industrial Revolution. If you want to date it back to 1800 or late 1700s, you were seeing a lot of urbanization. People are moving into cities. In fact, I think most of the countries involved in this war have majority urban populations. That's very new in world history. Technological progress is just occurring rapidly. You're seeing electricity coming online and all these different new things. And that has a big impact on cultural changes. And it would seem that this technological progress is leading to a more secular ideology or outlook. If you could comment on what this intellectual and spiritual landscape looks like at the, say, turn of the century, the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Right. One of the things that's very surprising, we obviously tend to think of this in terms of secularism, of secularization. But let me draw a very sharp distinction. In many Western countries, there's a strong move against the established churches, against orthodoxy. Socialists especially are very anti-clerical, and you have a full-scale culture war in France and to some extent in Germany. In fact, the phrase culture war comes directly from the late 19th century struggle between the German state and the Catholic Church. However, having said that, people absolutely do not abandon spiritual ideas, often of a very unorthodox kind. So in many countries, this is a great age for Orthodox Christianity, whether we mean that Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox. But among intellectuals, they move away from those church ideas, and they move to ideas that we today would call esoteric, occult, New Age. if there's one movement that we see absolutely everywhere in this story, it's this group called Theosophy, which is founded in America and Britain in 1875. It's founded under the leadership of a woman called Madame Blavatsky, and it teaches these very New Age ideas about ancient civilizations, ancient Atlantis, reincarnation, and so on and so on. It is very hard to find an artist, a writer, a thinker, anywhere in the West, around about 1910, who is not deeply interested in Theosophy. And that's one of those elements that we tend not to pay attention to. Connected with that, round about 1910, if there's a central idea that unites intellectuals and thinkers, it's of an imminent end of the world. For Christians, the apocalyptic, millenarian ideas are very strong. But if you belong to these New Age, these theosophical ideas, you're fascinated by notions of angels, of a great change in world history that is approaching. And there's also a practical factor there, which is if you're a young guy in your 20s, by 1910, you know that a world war is imminent because so many of the crises around the world are pointing that way. You know you're going to be drafted. You're probably going to die in war, as most of them did. And that is reflected in your art. So art, culture, literature in the 5 or 10 years before the First World War are absolutely soaked with ideas of what? Angels, apocalypse, Armageddon. A nice little trilogy there. You know, the greatest Russian novel of this period is one called Petersburg, which describes how the then capital of Russia lives under the constant threat of angels and Armageddon. So there is a sense, not so much of doom, but of a great coming world change. And, you know, in some ways this is very surprising. We, as you absolutely rightly say, we would expect this to be a very secular era, and it absolutely isn't. It's the era of what has been called the spiritual unrest. Not exactly a great awakening, but an acute sharpening of interest in spiritual matters around the world. 1914 hits at one of these great moments of spiritual fascination, and that does much to account for many of the visions and ideas and themes that we would see throughout the war.
Yeah, and when I was reading through your book, I couldn't help but think about our current environment as well. And as you were just talking about how intellectuals would get caught into various fads, the how do you pronounce that?
Theosophy.
Wow, that's a strange term. But you just look around at our own colleagues. We won't mention any by name, but you know, they fall into a lot of very interesting faddish traps, and they're against the common religious orthodoxy of the day. But nonetheless, it's steeped in a lot of end times, and you know, with all the internet changes and technological changes that are occurring today, there just seems to be a similar vibe in the world right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And many people would say see that as having been true for a while, but where it's very strongly true is in the 1980s. And if you think about it, there's always a kind of secular apocalyptic. In the 1980s, it was the nuclear winter fear, and I suppose global warming plays something of that role today. Does not mean that is not a real phenomenon, but that has attracted a great deal of secular apocalyptic sentiment.
Yeah. Well, let's rewind the tape a bit and go back to the Great and Holy War. And your book is divided into two sections. There's a really fascinating way that you organize this book. The first one is talking about some of the things that we've already touched upon here, which are the religious overtones of the Great War. And then the second part is the war's impact on the religious alignment of the world that we've been living with unto this day. So we're going to come back to that in a second, but let's start with the actual war itself and explore why you call it the Holy War. And I think part of this understanding, and as you just mentioned, if you were a 20-year-old in 1910, you have this sense of apocalypse coming. And guess what? You're kind of proven right, because World War One is just one of these absolutely brutal wars. I mean, just give us a sense of what is occurring in the war, just in terms of its devastation.
Well, the simplest raw number would be in terms of deaths related to the war. The figure I use is around 10 million military fatalities. A lot of people would say that's an underestimate, and it's more like 14 or 15 million. Apart from that, then you have to include civilians, mainly massacred in the Middle East. So say another 4 or 5 million civilians. But then, of course, the war makes possible the great influenza pandemic of 1918. And that might have killed, and estimates vary, between 50 and 100 million people, far more than the actual fatalities in the battlefront. And in some ways, that would have been the greatest catastrophe in human history. It's certainly up there with the Black Death. And just to make a very grim story worse, in many parts of the world, the killing does not stop in 1918. And some of the worst bloodshed happens in areas of Eastern Europe between about 1918 and 22. So it's a very, very dark time.
Yeah, one of the figures that you had mentioned at the outset of your book, too, was that on August 22nd of 1914, right, which is just a few days away from its centennial, is the Battle of the Frontiers, where 27,000 combatants just on the French side alone were killed in one day, which is just the scale of
which
that.
Which is astonishing. It's about half as many military fatalities as the U.S. suffers in Vietnam over a 7-year period.
Right.
So it gives you an idea. The other thing that's a real shock is not so much that huge numbers of people die, but that the war goes on as long as it does. Based on previous wars, people had expected this would be a war basically of one summer. You know, be settled by September, October, and that was not an unreasonable idea. Something goes badly wrong at the Battle of the Marne in 1914, it becomes apparent that it's going to go on into 1915, 1916, and who knows, forever. And that is one of the absolute grimmest things that affects people.
Yeah, and I can imagine, too, with news getting out, and now you're starting to see the advent of photography on a wider scale, and dates back into the 1800s, but people are seeing this all the time, and this is going to affect the culture, the psychological makeup of individuals. And this plays out in the imagery of the war, how people represent what happens on battlefields, and then how they also present the war to the civilian populations. And, mm-hmm. and talk about that. One of the really interesting things that I did not know about, and your book opens with a story about the Angel of Mons, is how vivid an impression and how important that was for the mass culture. What was this Angel of Mons thing?
Right. Once upon a time, you certainly would not have had to ask that, because it was just one of the most famous stories in the world. The story is this. In August 1914, there is a very famous battle when a heavily outnumbered British force defeats a much larger German force. It's a heroic story in its own right. A British fantasy author called Arthur Machen writes a story, and it is absolutely explicitly, it is a fantasy story. It's not meant to be taken seriously. And the story is how these British soldiers at Mons, somebody jokingly says, "Oh, God and St. George, help us now." And accidentally, he's invoked a legion of dead English archers who lie buried near the place. They rise from the dead rise and fight the Germans and drive them off. And, it's a good story. Fairly soon after that, Machen was amazed, because he kept meeting people who had been at the battle and seen the ghost archers. And however hard he tried to deny it, they all knew that it was absolutely true, because a friend of a friend had seen the battle, had seen the arrow wounds in the German soldiers. The story then morphed, and we go from a bowman to an angel or angels that arose to protect the British. And that becomes absolutely canonical story through the war. People make films about it, they do comic books about it, they compose musical pieces about it. The Angel of Mons is taken as gospel truth. And it runs through the whole war. And in fact, you can go online right now and you can see stories about that. That is a very famous story, but what's interesting for me is not that that is told and believed, but that it's one of a great many stories, mainly focusing on angels, fitting in exactly with these ideas that I said had been around and so influential before the war, and absolutely central to the ideology, rhetoric, and imagery of both sides. The Germans absolutely have their angels. They claim the protection of Archangel Michael when they launched the Great Offensive in 1918 against the British. It's Operation Michael. So what I'm saying is that's one manifestation of this being what we might call an angel's war.
An angel's war. Now, you document this very well, and I, in terms of the Angel of Mons, too, I had never heard of it. I think I can blame some of those secular historians for poo-pooing it and pushing it off to the side. But when I looked this up, the imagery's all over the place. There's paintings galore, and as you mentioned, comic books, and you do a wonderful job of documenting this. Now, is this just in the popular imagery of the war, just amongst the general hoi polloi, the general population, or is this also promoted by elites when they're talking about mobilizing individuals to go to the Western Front?
Right. It runs across the whole of society. You know, for me, one of the most interesting places of the war actually precedes the war. In 1913, the Germans erected a great monument to a great victory of Napoleon back in 1813. And if you look at that place in Leipzig, that memorial, it is absolutely full of these images of angels, of crusaders, of warriors. And if you look at the imagery, it's actually spooky because it looks like in 1913 they're foretelling both world wars, because it looks like First World War German imagery and also Second World War Nazi imagery. But all through the war, when people make propaganda posters, this religious imagery is constant. It's an imagery of, what are the main elements? Angels, absolutely. Crusaders. When you portray women, commonly they're represented with angels' wings. And the other one, which runs through the war, very, very powerful. What is more powerful in a Christian country than crucifixion? Crucifixion in different forms runs through the war. And the idea is, we're a Christian country fighting another Christian country. How do we justify this? Well, we have to show that they are not really Christian. They are hypocrites. They are soldiers of the devil. And we can prove that by the fact that they crucify our people. They crucify prisoners, they crucify hostages, and so on. So that religious imagery is an absolute staple of what we might call propaganda. I always try to be very careful with the word propaganda. Propaganda suggests something which is visited from on high, and it may or may not achieve a popular audience. What I'm suggesting is that the ideas run across classes, across groups, and the governments that are trying to present these images do it because they know people already believe it. They very literally are preaching to the converted.
Yeah, and I would expect that, but there's an interesting passage that you have in your book. This comes fairly early on page 15. Let me read this to you and sure. Get a more detailed explanation of what you meant here. You say, quote, "Looking at the proliferation of visions and revelations, we might be tempted to think that governments were actively promoting such tales to strengthen morale and benefit the war effort. To the contrary, though, both states and churches spent a good deal of time actively trying to suppress popular claims." Right. So it seems there's a counter pressure there, too. What's going on?
Some of these ideas are very useful. If, for example, you're British and you have a common belief that the Germans are of the devil, then, you know, that's great. Let's go with that. But there are other ideas, there are other visions that governments actually try to suppress. Suppose, for example, you've heard a story that angels have appeared and they've said that peace will only come when all the different combatants realize that they must achieve justice. Well, governments don't like to hear that. They don't want to hear that all governments are equally bad, so they try and suppress stories like that. The other great example is in 1917, the British are fighting in the Middle East. They're fighting the Turks. And everyone in the media says, okay, this is a crusade. And finally, the British take Jerusalem, and this is presented as, this is what the crusaders wanted. The British government becomes apoplectic at that. They don't want this discussed in terms of a crusade because Britain relies so heavily on its Muslim soldiers. They don't want Muslims being told that they're fighting in a Christian crusade. And so they try to use their very strict censorship powers to forbid people in the media calling it a crusade. It's very much like happens after 9/11, where initially people like President Bush spoke in terms of almost a religious war. The campaign in Afghanistan was infinite justice. And pretty soon they realized, no, we can't do that. We're just going to alienate Muslims whose support we need. So there's a lot of evidence that ordinary people believe a lot of this religious thought, and governments are trying to suppress it, which goes the exact opposite way from what we might normally assume.
Mm-hmm. One of the other prominent themes in your book, and a prominent theme during this period of time, is the imagery of end times. And this is the coming of the apocalypse, and combined with the Battle of Armageddon. We just mentioned that the war was fought there in the Middle East, in the Holy Land. And so, one could only start to draw parallels there, one would assume. And in secular terms, too, we hear an echo of this. We hear World War I as the war to end all wars. There's some kind of end times and something is coming here. Speak to that issue. What was the end times themes within World War I?
Well, just to take one small movement, in the Jehovah's Witnesses had actually said that prophesied for years that 1914 would be the year of Armageddon, so that was a pretty good guess. Armageddon ideas are very strong. I already mentioned that in the years before the war, many people, both Orthodox and on the esoteric side of things, are talking about the imminent end of the world. That's a large part of the religious revivalism. And then you have something like this with these astonishing numbers of fatalities, a war that goes on that involves all these super scientific weapons, these tanks and aircraft and so on. It's very tempting to think in terms of apocalypse. And by 1917, we see a lot of evidence of that. We get the great prophecy, again introduced initially by an angel at Fatima, mm-hmm. which spreads throughout the Catholic world. That seems to indicate the end times. If you read the book of Revelation, you get angels, a vision of the woman crowned with stars, and that's exactly what's supposed to have happened at Fatima. Then the British take Jerusalem, and then in 1918, the British win their great victory over the Turks at, where else? Megiddo, the site of the Battle of Armageddon. You have famine, death, and war, and then 1918 brings the fourth of the Four Horsemen, plague, in the form of the great influenza epidemic. By 1918, if you don't believe the end of the world is nigh, then you're not paying attention. So it's not at all surprising that we have these very strong end times speculation. And people are focusing on who the Antichrist might be. Might it be the Kaiser? The Germans, in turn, many of them point to England possibly as being the diabolical force. Some of them focus on the Jews. So those end times apocalyptic ideas are very strong.
The one thing that really struck me when I was reading the book was that you pulled very broadly across the Europe and across the world, and the vision at Fatima, the three kids that had the vision. You often hear about that. It's very important in Catholic history. The kids have been given sainthood, and But I never really connected it to the war, in part because Portugal, you know, they played a role in it, but basically blockading some German ships, etc. Not a large role. But you do connect it to this whole wartime milieu.
Oh, sure. Well, as I said, if you look at Fatima, for example, we often forget that Portugal was a country that had just entered the war.
Mm-hmm.
It suffers a lot of fatalities, proportionately, probably far more than the United States would suffer, given its tiny size. There are all these very great tensions in the country. And we have to understand the miracle, such as it is, in that sense. It's very closely related to a particular set of political circumstances, and not just in the war, but then with the Bolshevik revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you say Fatima, of course, is very influential, right up to our own day. John Paul II, for instance, was obsessed with Fatima.
Mm-hmm. No, it is actually very fascinating. Now, one of the other observations you make with this imagery, too, and you just mentioned Russia on the verge of the Bolshevik Revolution. We talked earlier about the strong imagery in Germany, was that the imagery, the religious imagery, was much stronger in Germany and Russia than it was in, say, Britain and the United States. What do you attribute this to?
I'm sorry, can you just say that question one more time? I'm sorry.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, we were just talking about how Russia on the verge of the Bolshevik Revolution had very strong religious imagery. And earlier we were talking about this, too, in relation to Germany. And one of the observations that you make was that the religious imagery was much stronger in Germany and Russia than, say, in Britain or the United States. What do you attribute that to?
Boy, it's not so much necessarily that the imagery is stronger, but that it is stronger in elite circles. So, for instance, you know, Britain and France are actually very religious countries, but in different ways. You don't have the same kind of penetration. And in France, for instance, the government is notionally very secular, very anti-church, anti-religious. And then they have the problem of trying to mobilize a war, and the only way they can do it is by mobilizing all these very devotedly Catholic people. What's different about Germany and Russia is that actually in the war, religious thought of a very apocalyptic character is something which is closely held by leading people in politics, in the military. One of the examples I choose, the only great success of Russia in the war is led by a general called Brusilov, and leads this great, very successful campaign. If you look at Brusilov, then of course he's absolutely soaked in these occult theosophical ideas. He's a spiritualist. And he's another example of these people you look at and think, well, he must be, you know, an isolated eccentric, and then you realize that they're all isolated eccentrics.
Yep. All eccentrics together, and that makes a common theme. I want to now switch to the second major theme in your book, and that deals with the consequences of World War I on the spiritual alignment in the world. And it manifests itself with three major Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I want to start with Christianity first. It's the dominant religion in the combatants of the war on the European front. In probably the best line in your entire book, and I just love this line. I'm thinking making a, you know, posting it somewhere because it's so good. You write, "The sleep of religion brings forth monsters." What do you mean by that?
Well, obviously, I'm bouncing off a famous quote from a painting of Goya, and what he says is, "The sleep of reason brings forth monsters," mm-hmm. and he depicts that visually. But what I'm saying is, when mainstream Orthodox religions enter crisis, when they go through a period of catastrophe, when if you think of it, they sleep, then people's passions will still surface, but they will do so in much more frightening forms. So, for example, I talk about Germany, where you have these strongly nationalist ideas in the churches prior to 1914. Well, the churches are badly hit by the war. Many of those hopes are disappointed, but those same passions, those same ideas are there, but they surface outside the churches, outside the form of mainstream Christianity, and in the German case, of course, specifically in Nazism, there's an absolutely obvious continuity from pre-war ideology through Nazism. The difference is, of course, that it does not take the explicitly religious form. But the anti-Semitism, for example, you can see that emerging in the churches at the end of the war. The idea that the holy nation of Germany failed in its great crusade because it was stabbed in the back by these evil outsiders, and pretty soon that they label the Jews as being responsible for that. It's a fundamental building block of Nazism. You see something very similar in the other great holy nation, which is Russia. And there, of course, a lot of the apocalyptic, millenarian passion ends up in Bolshevism. And it's often remarkable how explicitly religious some of the imagery of the anti-religious Bolsheviks is. One of the great persecutors of the church was a woman called Alexandra Kollontai, who frankly called herself the female Antichrist. They know the language, they know the imagery, but they're just standing it on its head. So, as I say, the sleep of religion brings forth monsters, and I would say that is the history of Europe in the 20 or so years between the First and the Second World Wars.
You show the continuity between the strong religious imagery pre-war in Germany and Russia and continue it through Nazism and Bolshevism, but how is the rest of Europe affected by the war in terms of its spiritual landscape?
Oh boy, Europe, of course, is many many different countries. You know, we often think in terms of a great disenchantment after the war, and there really isn't. At least through the 1920s, Europe continues to be a very religious society. And the big variable is whether countries felt that they had won the war. And in some countries that were defeated, that had suffered particularly badly, we see something like the German and Russian model. One of the great examples I always look at is Romania, a country that suffered terribly in the war, and which comes from an Orthodox tradition, but which has a very German trajectory. It acquires this radically violent anti-Semitic tradition, which is under a group that takes the name of, it's the Legion of the Archangel Michael. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to get away from angels in this era, the sleep of religion once again. But as I say, different countries follow different patterns, but whether they are secular in theory or not, they all tend to build on these old wartime ideas.
One of the other strands that you talk about, too, in terms of Christianity and what happens after the war, connects with one of your earlier books, the Christendom book. I'm forgetting it right now. It's
The Next Christendom.
The Next Christendom. I was going to say the Great Christendom, but The Next Christendom. And that's the movement from Christianity being a phenomena largely associated with Europe to one that is just becomes explosive in what we now call the Global South. Discuss that.
Right. If you look just at the year 1915, it's a year of catastrophe for Christians in terms of that being the uprooting of ancient Christian communities in the Middle East, particularly among the Armenian and Assyrian people. But equally, that's exactly the time at which Christianity takes off in a huge way in Black Africa, a region that is profoundly affected by the war and specifically by the influenza pandemic of a couple of years later. If you look at many of the most successful churches in West Africa today, they trace their history specifically to that influenza pandemic of 1918, and to the prophetic healing that arose in response to it. This is the moment at which Black African Christianity takes off, really becomes autonomous, and begins the expansion, which will culminate in not too long, when Africa becomes the largest Christian continent. That is an aftermath of the First World War.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating how you talk about that in the book, and the role of the, what we oftentimes think of as called the Spanish flu, but it's really a global pandemic, really has an impact on this. And so interesting stuff there. What about some of the other faiths? Are there other impacts on, for instance, Judaism? I mean, you mentioned anti-Semitism really starts to take off in places like Germany and Romania, other parts of Europe as well. How is Judaism impacted?
Right. I would argue that modern Jewish history is the product of the First World War, and we see that in different ways. But just to take the most spectacular events, in 1917, the British government issues the Balfour Declaration, promising what would become the land of Israel to the Jewish people as a homeland. That could not have happened if it had not been for the millenarian apocalyptic ideas of many of the evangelical members of the British government at that point. It could not have happened without things like the British taking Jerusalem in 1917. On the other side, I would argue that the roots of the radical anti-Semitism that culminated in the Holocaust have to be traced to the First World War, and particularly the spread of vicious Russian anti-Semitism in Germany. So I think Jewish history in the 20th century is absolutely shaped by the First World War experience. The other great religion, obviously, is Islam. The last great Islamic power, the Ottoman Empire, collapses during the war, and in 1924 they abolish the caliphate. I would argue that the whole subsequent history of Islam, all the various movements, reforms, revivals, are a response to that event, and particularly to the winding up of the caliphate, something which was much more in the news in the last few months because of the attempt by the ISIS movement in the Middle East to restore a caliphate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the connections there are very important, and I think in the West we lost track of that. We think of the Ottoman Empire, the sick man of Europe, eventually falling, and well, that's the end of that story there, and that won't have any impact. But the history keeps moving in the Middle East, and you know, comes back to some might say haunt us in the West here in the past decade or two. Let me go ahead and ask a final question as we draw close here. Your book was a fascinating read, not only because it helped us to reflect upon this centennial anniversary that we are celebrating now. I guess celebrating is a bad word, but remembering now.
Commemorating
is a better word. And it helps us that also to remind us that history is important, but it does, as I just mentioned, tells us that history is vividly relevant for today. And as a student of history, I've learned to take a lot of contemporary bad times in stride, knowing that there were always some really, really dark days in world history. You go back to 1914, 1915, and you say, wow, that was a real horrible time to be alive. And you know, you kind of look at your present situation and think, well, you know, that's not that big a deal. But you know, today, and we're recording this in early August of 2014, I look around and I just see the world completely melting down like I've never seen it in my lifetime. And I just can't help to draw parallels here. You got the conflict in Gaza and the Ukraine. You got ISIS, as we just talked about, exploding all over the Middle East. You got Ebola outbreaks, and everything is going on all at once here. Whenever you're writing these stories, do you sit back and say, wow, I'm watching the evening news, and it just seems what played out in 1914 seems to be playing out again?
But you know, you look at many different periods, and you see some parallels there. Some of the ones which actually really bother me most. Just assume for the sake of argument that the story of 1914 is a number of countries that don't want a war in the immediate future. They're prepared to consider it down the road. And then there's one little thing, one little spark that nobody wants to go anywhere generates into this huge war. The analogy that strikes me is not so much in the Middle East. It is in the China Sea. And it's the tensions between China and Japan and the United States. And if there's a place where you could see a really local conflict, one stupid act by one ship's captain, for example, turning into a major confrontation, that is the part of the world where I would seriously worry, where countries that do not want war could stumble into it, or as the phrase goes, could sleepwalk into catastrophe. That's the situation that I would see as the greatest potential analogy. And I think that's probably a good nightmare scenario on which we can wind up.
Well, let's hope that nightmare doesn't come true. It's been fascinating to talk to Philip Jenkins here. The book that we were just talking about is The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade. Philip, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
And thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.